It is now understood, finally, that adverse childhood experiences, called ACE, A-C-E, can have devastating effects years after they occur. This has inspired the title of Don't Gamble with Your Life, Play the ACE. Two medical doctors at Kaiser Permanente, which is a large health maintenance organization in California, started the ACE study back in the 90s. And this is how it came about. They were having a weight loss program in which three people were doing extremely well, and then they quit the program. The doctor in charge, Filetti, decided to interview individually those people to find out why they would drop out when they were doing so well. He talked to one woman and two men. The men were friends and they worked together. The woman said that as she started to lose weight, she started to attract the attention of men and it made her uncomfortable. In a deeper conversation, it was revealed that this woman had been sexually abused as a child. The two guys were guards at a penitentiary, and individually, when they started to lose weight, they were no longer, in quotes, bigger than life, end quotes, and it was making them feel very vulnerable being around prisoners in a high-security prison. Deeper conversation led to the fact that both of them had been sexually abused when they were boys. All of a sudden, this doctor says, wow, I can understand what is going on with childhood experiences, and maybe they're major factors in a whole bunch of things, weight gain and refusal to lose weight. And so that was the beginning of the ACE study. The Centers for Disease Control contributed, and between Kaiser Permanente and CDC, this program, this analysis of Kaiser Permanente patients or members went on for years. Some 17,000 people whose records were very detailed at Kaiser Permanente were analyzed, and then the people were questioned with a simple questionnaire. Basically, 9 complex questions, complex meaning they had, you know, there were like 2 parts to each question. And if they answered yes, they experienced that, they got a 1. And then the total number of points was potentially 9. And it was recognized that people with higher numbers had a greater tendency to have problems in life, illnesses of various kinds, problems earlier on in their lives. So it was interesting to be able to see the correlation now, because they had all this data from their 17,000 members. I think the average age originally was about 55 years old. They're looking back at their lives and they could see that if they had a higher number of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, those people tended as youngsters, teenagers, young adults, to engage in risky behaviors or experiment with alcohol or drugs more than others. They had sex too early. They had unwanted pregnancies. The illnesses that they were correlating to ACEs were multiple sclerosis, cancers, high blood pressure, and on and on and on. And then it became the question of, wow, what do we do about it? Well, Dr. Filetti thought, well, if the problems are arising because of events during childhood, what we ought to be doing is figuring out a way how to help a child right after an adverse childhood experience, rather than when they're 55 and they've developed all kinds of problems in their lives. If you want to take a look at the questions, go to this website, ACE, A-C-E, study, one word, acestudy.org, and you can read the questions, and you can make your own determination whether adverse childhood experiences were significant in your life or the life of somebody important to you, or maybe somebody else in your family. Some years back, I was at an event that we were conducting in Virginia, about this time of the year, trying to bring veterans out of the woods because it was going to become winter and these people were subject to freezing to death. So the idea of this event was to bring people back, have them get into the VA system, have mental and physical checkups, dental checkups right there on the spot. Talking to a social worker who was there as well, he said to me, he'd worked in the prison system in Virginia, and it was this fact that I found shocking, never heard before or since. He said 80% of the violent criminals in prison were sexually abused as boys. Now he's talking obviously about male prisoners, which is the population he worked with. 80% of them were sexually abused as children. He said their self-hatred and that they knows no limits. And so when they trying to move that energy out, they're violent, they harm other people. Knowing that says punishment is not the answer. Healing is the answer. But the prison industry says, no, I make money having these people recycle all the time. Recidivism is good for my business. It may be bad for society, but it's good for me. So, how do we play the ace? And I'm making reference to that in a couple of different ways. Obviously, adverse childhood experiences, but also from a card game. We think, oh, that's an ace. Ace of spades, ace of hearts, ace of diamonds, ace of clubs. All powerful cards. But play the ace. You recognize that when we play, we tend to have more fun, we lighten up, and that's essential to us. Lighten up. We've got to lighten up about our experiences. Now, a lot of our experiences are very heavy in the first place, and it's like, it's a tragedy, it's a trauma, you want me to lighten up about it? Yes. Yep, I think we would be much better off if we did. In the final analysis, these experiences, whether they were painful or pleasurable, and anything in between, are experiences. They're energy exchange experiences. Energy came to us, and energy came from us. So we're exchanging energy with our environments all the time. I'm sitting in a chair. Obviously, I'm exchanging energy with it. I can feel the chair. Presumably the chair can feel me because it's the springs in it change when I sat down on it. So our energy exchange experiences, you listening right now, is an energy exchange experience. Some of them please us, and that would be nice if most of them please us. But some of them scare us. Some of them hurt us, confuse us, shatter us, anger us, embarrass us, shame us, overwhelm us, fragment us, humiliate us, demean us, abuse us. But they don't destroy us. At least they don't have to. We have the power there. Now, all of those words that I used may have happened, but ultimately, if we're listening, we're not destroyed. If we can process information, we're not destroyed. We can be like the character in the Terminator movies. I don't know if you've seen that. Arnold Schwarzenegger was in it at one point, and he went from a bad guy to a good guy in maybe the subsequent movies, and then another bad guy. But they would get blown up, and it looked like they were liquid mercury, but then they would come back together again. They would coalesce. They would become whole. So they got fragmented, and then they would become whole again, and do their bad things to the stars of the movie. That ability to reassemble selves, we have that. And it's really a definition of the word healing. We go like, I'm broken. My skin is broken. My bones are broken. My this is broken. And it comes back together again. That's healing. That's repair. That's becoming whole. Playing is a lighter way to exchange energies. Let's go play out in the playground. Let's go play baseball. Let's go play, you name it. It's designed to be fun. Now, recently I've learned how to play two card games. Pitch and Nines. Was unfamiliar with them a month ago. But they're fun. They're kind of nice. But that's different too. Because previously I never really liked playing cards or most games. I didn't know how to lighten up. It always seemed like to me when I was engaged in what people thought were games, it was a do or die. It was, you know, it was a like survival. It was to prove something as compared to, no, it's to have fun. Like, I don't get it. What does that mean? But that's what it is. For me, games weren't fun, but that's now changed. I like that. This idea of lightening up, having more fun, I've known about that since 1976. In 1976, I went to a famous psychic, Erwin Greif, in Brooklyn. And in the course of this reading, he said many things important to me, but one of which, you're going to want to work at lightening up. Lightening up. If you do, it'll be so much easier for other people to hear you. You'll be more effective. You'll feel better about yourself. You'll be more productive. You got to figure out a way to lighten up. I said to Erwin, okay. But after I left, wasn't long before I went right back into my old habit of seriousness and difficulty. Oh, I gotta hunker down. I gotta be serious about this. This is life or death. I don't think so, but I thought about it then. So, you think about this. If you want to move a piece of furniture, you wouldn't make it heavier before you had to move it, right? You wouldn't, oh, I think I'll put some books on it and bricks and fill it full and then try to move it. You wouldn't do that. You would say, whoa, you know, let's empty the drawers or maybe even remove the drawers if that's easier. And let's get glides, silicone glides. We'll put them under the feet and we can just slide this thing. Oh, and there's less resistance. Some years back when Marianne and I were moving furniture in the house, she bought these silicone glides to put under furniture. And I did it, lifted it, put them under the legs, and I went, you know what? When I'm old, like 112 or 13 years old, I'm still going to be able to move furniture because I'll use these glides. And with one finger, I can move heavy couches and dressers and desks anywhere I want. Wow, how fantastic is this? When you really think of it, those glides reduce the resistance that otherwise would occur between the foot of the furniture and the carpet or the floor. Reducing resistance. How cool is that? So we would say moving furniture, a piano or a dresser or a table that's being delivered on Tuesday to me, if it's lighter, it's going to be easier to move. Yep, that's true. If the energy is lighter, it will be easier to move. If you want to move energy, and I'm not talking about furniture now, I'm talking about energy. If it's lighter, if you want to write a novel, the lighter you can be about that novel, the better you're going to be. If it's a painting or a picture you're painting or drawing, the lighter you can feel about that, the easier that energy is going to flow out of that pencil or that paintbrush. So, how can we lighten up about an adverse childhood experience? That's it. I'm not going to let go of that. I'm not going to forget that bad thing that happened to me. Why? We think if we hold on to that memory and don't deal with it, don't heal it, don't change our viewpoint about it, it somehow is going to prevent it from occurring again. The trouble is we have now dampened our own spirit because we've driven ourselves into the self-protect mode because we're constantly focusing our attention on something that scares us, makes us feel bad. Like, oh, yeah. But I would say one of the keys to lightening up is awareness. Awareness. If we refuse to know more about an event that hurt us or imbalanced us or damaged our sense of ourselves, we are preventing the inflow of awareness that would help us heal the relationship with ourselves. You know, when we went into a relationship with an event, let's say the event hasn't happened, we walk into that as an individual. But if we get overwhelmed, dominated, or shattered, or hurt in some way, when we come out of that, we're not the same one individual. We could be many pieces of us. And we make decisions about who we are as a result of that collision. That it should have been an energy exchange experience of moderate intensity, but if it was a collision that dominated us, we have a different experience. Our son Jonathan and a girlfriend of his years ago gave us a gift of a red glass heart that sits on the table. It's beautiful. That beautiful, but because it's glass, it's also delicate. If it were dropped, it would shatter. Now, just imagine on the floor these pieces of heart. You get it? You and I have been mishandled. We've been dropped. We've been hurt. Maybe we've even been shattered by the experiences of the way we've been handled by people in our families or outside of our families. Instead of the whole individual, I'm whole, I'm healthy, I'm healed, we would have pieces of us. And those pieces of us are vying to be our identity. Just imagine that. We walk into an event, we're one person. We come out of that event, we're more than one person. Now, we've got these different pieces of, oh, I'm foolish that I walked into that blindly. I'm so naive. I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other thing. There are any number of pieces that we could walk out of there with. And those things are going, this is who we are. And the other piece says, no, this is who we are. And another piece says, no, this is who we are. As we consider this, are we wonderful? As that one, at least one person, one piece of us would say that, yeah, we're wonderful. Or are we bad? Which one or more pieces are saying that about us? Are we beautiful or are we ugly? Are we smart or stupid? Kind or mean? Capable or worthless? And the possible labels for the pieces or fragments of us, of our self-image, of our identity, could go on and on and on. Are you diligent? Are you lazy? Right? We've heard so many different things like that. We've heard it delivered to us. We've heard it other people delivering it to others. And we have delivered those kind of words to ourselves. Here's the thing, though. The idea that we're beautiful or ugly, it's just a made-up point of view. It's fabricated. It's made up. It's just a chosen way of looking at oneself or at others. But we're creative. We can make up all kinds of things, and that happens to be an example of two diametrically opposed pieces. Are we beautiful or are we ugly? You can hear how limited those two choices are. That's it. On or off, up or down, black or white, that's beautiful or ugly, that's it. Those are the only choices I have. That idea, that thinking is so common, but it's binary, which means there are only two choices. You would either have to be beautiful or you would have to be ugly. That's it. And of course, that's false. What's beautiful and what's ugly? That's a spectrum. There's a scale. And even those words are subject to the viewpoint of the observer, right? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? Oh, this idea has been dealt with some time ago. No kidding. and we're still dealing with it, and we are the beholder. Then why would we hold on to such a limited viewpoint that chains us to bad feelings? I'm going to hold on to this, what I've been told about myself, or what I've reinforced after having heard it, and it gives me bad feelings. Yeah, okay. But why do you hold on to that? I think it's because we don't understand what we're doing, and we don't understand how to do something different. Some years ago, I don't know, 15 years ago maybe, about that time, everybody was talking about attention deficit disorder, ADD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I actually think those things were brought into the mainstream by Big Pharma because it was a great way to make obscene profits. Everybody needed, oh, look at that boy, he's got ADD. Boom, boom, let's pump some medicine into that kid. Let's do drugs on that kid. Yeah, think about it. Nobody, except truly brain damage, you know, if there's something missing physically inside their skull, has attention deficit. We all have attention. Now it's a question of, you have 100 units of attention. Maybe they're different than mine, but because I'm maybe bigger or smaller than you. So the fact is, we could have a different amount of attention, but the fact is, we have it. So how about a person with ADD putting their attention on a lot of things, whereas somebody else is putting their attention on a fewer number of things? Now, a school teacher might say, you know what, kids, put your attention on what I'm saying and what I'm writing on the blackboard. And those people that could control their attention to do that and nothing else, would say, oh, these kids are good, they're normal, they're just what we want. But other people who are more electric, guess what, those are boys, they're sitting there, they want to run, they want to play, they got so much energy in their little boy bodies that they can't sit still. And we go, oh, we got to medicate these kids. They have, they're normal boys, but there's a lot of profit in pathologizing those kind of things and writing prescriptions for them. If a kid has experiences of abuse, and just think, they've been abused, guess what? They're fragmented. And so one fragment is looking out for this, another is looking for that, another is looking for that. And now all of a sudden you go, this kid's attention is scattered over too many things. And in addition to that, these fragments are battling for control. Be careful of this, and look out for that, and attack that, and run from this, and you're like, wow, those are a lot of conversations going on in the head of a child. Yeah, and I think that's really what's happening. But we understand this idea. Even if you don't have ADD, most people can, with or without ADD, would say, you know what? I can feel the need to attend to possible threats more than possible pleasure. Why? Because from a survival standpoint, there's real value there. I just think I'm going to go out for a walk. I heard a growl outside my cave, but I'm going to go for a walk because it'll be fun. That bloodline is gone. It got turned into a meal. But the other person goes, uh-oh, what's that growl? I'm not going out. Oh, no, no, no. You know, not going to happen. So those people listening to possible threats have a tendency to live longer, provided they don't manufacture threats, which puts their body into the self-protect mode, shuts down the immune system effectively, and interferes with other important, not urgent, but important body functions, and that person now is susceptible to illness and, of course, the ultimate death. Like, oh, So you turn around and look at somebody who's got ADD and you're like, I wonder what threats this person has experienced and is trying to be alert to. Looking around, look. We need to have the ability to put our attention on a painful past energy exchange experience, because that ability can be improved through practice. We've got to be able to look at stuff, to observe stuff. And if we can put our attention on some event, and a lot of people, I don't, you know, it's like a splinter in a child's finger. No, don't touch it. It's going to hurt. Yes, it is. But if I remove it, it's only going to hurt for 30 seconds. Whereas if I don't remove it, it's going to become infected and it's going to cause you a lot of pain. It's like, okay, short-term pain, long-term pain. Okay, I will look at it. Let's deal with the splinter. Let's make contact with it. And that's what we can develop the ability to do. Now, in transcendental meditation, and I was initiated when I was in the Army in Panama in 1972, the goal was to let go of any and all viewpoints. Just quiet mind. Quiet mind. So if you weren't busy playing with your own viewpoint, guess what? You had the ability to let go of stuff because you weren't trying to hold on to things. You weren't trying to defend yourself. And today I would say you're in a position, because of the quietness, to receive awareness. Maybe even hear that still small voice within. You go, okay, that makes sense. In Scientology, that I experienced in 1979 and 1980, actually, they have a communications training program, and the goal of that was to teach you and train you to have the skill to be able to attend to somebody and what they were saying without becoming emotionally or mentally activated by what they were saying with our own stuff. So somebody was describing their own abuse. It was like, oh, God, that reminds me of my own abuse. That was not part of the goal. The goal was to be able to hear what they were saying, be able to see the reactions on their face and their body without it making it all about us. And I think both skills are really important in transcendental meditation and in prayer and the healing codes and other modalities. The absence of our own viewpoint allows awareness to penetrate our consciousness. If we only want to know what we already know, we're pretty limited and there's not much growth that's going to occur. Why? Because I'm recycling the same stuff for the last 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years. Same stuff. It's like, well, haven't you added anything new? No, I'm just repeating. That's boring. That's not much growth. That doesn't sound very exciting to me. So if we can turn off our viewpoint, and it allows us to open the doors to our heart and mind so something can arrive. And to be able to observe other people without becoming emotionally triggered breaks the habit of making everything about us, which myself and others have a tendency to do. Oh, it's all about me. It's all about me. But instead, we just observe and know that we are seeing energy and we're seeing experiences. Doesn't really require us to judge. Doesn't really require us to make them right or wrong. It doesn't require us to make ourselves better or worse than them. There's no need for comparison. In order for us to add viewpoints, to move out of that limited binary space that I was talking about a little while ago, it's important to know which viewpoints you already have. This means you need to have courage enough to observe your own viewpoints, which I'll go back to what I was referring to a little while ago, too. This is like the splinter in your finger. Oh, no, I'm not looking at this. No, I don't want to know. Yes, you do want to know. If you know, you can improve. If you don't know, pretty hard to improve. And if you use this model, and I don't actually know if it's true or not, but I think it's a meaningful way to look at stuff, that each piece, each fragment of your identity that resulted from one of these collisions that occurred with an energy exchange experience, perhaps when you were expecting warmth and love and got just the opposite, like, whoa, I didn't protect myself. Or you had certain intentions that if you did X, it would result in Y, but you did X and it didn't result in that. It, in fact, boomeranged and caused pain for you or other people. And you're like, oh man, that's not what I had in mind. Yep. But if you're willing to think of this fragment of your identity has its own viewpoint. So I say, what's your viewpoint about X? Really, what I would be saying to you is, what are your various viewpoints about X? So give them to me. Well, I like it. I hate it. I'm lukewarm to it. I wish it were this. I don't think it's that. I never had it. And we would go through a whole bunch of viewpoints that would identify to us who we are and what we are. You go, oh, well, yeah. Maybe that's why I have so many viewpoints, because there's so many of me. One fragment, maybe even more, would say, you're beautiful. And one fragment, or maybe more, would say, you're ugly. Which fragment do you listen to? As we put our attention on a single event that conveyed the energy of you're ugly, we can allow our viewpoints to expand. It's just like, I remember the day when so-and-so said that to me. Or I overheard somebody say that about me. As children, our viewpoints all had us as the center of the situation, right? We're the center of the universe. Everything's about us. It was all about us as far as we are concerned. But now we can know that it's not true. It's not all about us. Everything that happened had many things happen before it, all leading up to the event. It's like, instead of looking at that event as a moment in time, it was like, well, what led up to that? What led up to that? And it's so obvious that this is how things work in life. You look at a sine wave that I'm a very big fan of. The thing goes, a wave that goes up and it goes down, and it goes up, it goes down. So about this time of the year, people are harvesting pumpkins, right? We're approaching Halloween tomorrow night. And it's like, oh, look, there's a pumpkin. Well, guess what? That pumpkin was a thought in the mind of the farmer. And then a lot of work to prepare the soil and the planting of the seeds way back, June or July. And now, over time, the maturation of that, oh, look, the pumpkin's growing out in the field. Yeah. They didn't just happen the day before Halloween. They were happening for a long period of time, maybe even years. Because, oh yeah, we grow pumpkins every year. This is a family tradition, that sort of thing. Everything that we experience had a whole bunch of energy patterns leading up to it. Everything that we do now will be the forerunner of what's going to be created later. And as we expand our viewpoints beyond our own feelings, because that's what we use, right? How is this? Is this good or is it bad? Hold on a second. Let me see what my feelings say. My feelings say this was bad. Okay. And not everybody would agree with that, because other people would have different experiences. But if we can expand beyond our feelings, we're going to see greater detail about the other people who participated in our abuse, in our collisions. We're going to be able to see that these energy exchange experiences were part of the wave of their own fears, their pain, their imbalance. And they were making an effort to mitigate their pain, their upset, their lack of control, their sense of being imbalanced or being not enough. And that's what they did. It's the same thing we do. And none of that is meant to excuse abusive behaviors. the awareness that you and I are looking for is not to excuse them, but it's to help us to be free of the chains of those painful events. Because if we had that occur when we were 5 or 6 or 8 or 10, and we're here 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years later, using the same reference of that happened when we were 5 or 6 or 8 or 10, I see it like, wow, don't we need to progress? And of course, the answer is yes, we do. If we can become free of that painful event, it no longer influences or controls, is a better way to say it, our behaviors from that point on, we're going to be in a position that we can live life differently, on a higher level, as compared to repeating patterns unrelentingly from the age of 5, 6, 8, or 10. Like, oh, that guy's 80 years old. Well, not really. Not really. He's like 6 years old. How do you know? Because he's just repeating the same stuff that occurred when he was 6. That's not life. That's not living. If you'll look at the conditions you're experiencing right now in your life, you can make a list of them. Make a list of them from a factual standpoint, not the made-up meanings that you've attached. Well, this means I'm this, or it means they are that. No, 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 no. Just the facts. You are a certain age, a certain weight, your health is, you've got conditions of, just those facts. That's a good way to start. Then make another list of what you have been told about you. What have you been told about you? And this is where I like to use the 12 worlds again. You know, what have you been told about you spiritually? Oh, God is going to punish you. Or mentally, oh, you're dumb. Or you're smart. Oh, you're smarter than the average bear. Or whatever you've been told. And emotionally, don't feel that way. Don't feel that way. Or physically, and this is where you get into appearance, or that we start to disown parts of our body, which is part of the fragmenting situation. Oh, I don't like my hair, my forehead, my nose, my eyes, my ears, my lips, my teeth, right? On and on and on. And you go like, how in the hell could I be whole when I'm at odds with almost every part of my body? You're not going to be whole because you're individuated in these little pieces as compared to one single individual. It's like, oh, so me hating my body parts, not a good idea. Not a good idea. Because it separates us into these fragments. We want to go back where we want to bring them back together again. We want to heal. We want to become whole. Those are the, I said the same thing two ways, heal and whole. So if you made a list of what you've heard about you, or anybody else in the family, because, you know, somebody's talking about your father or your mother or somebody else in the family, you're going to personalize that because you're a child. It's all about me. It's all about me. And include what you've told yourself about you. And you know what you've said about other people. And if you made a big point about criticizing somebody else over time in one way or another, law of cause and effect says you're going to reap that. That's coming back to you, either from you to you or from others to you. So it's nice to know ahead of time what that is. And you can do that by making a list of that. Why would somebody, anybody, say you are ugly? Where inside of them would that energy have resided for them to arrive at that judgment and want to project it onto you? Now, it could have been anything. Could have been talking about your looks, could have been talking about your intelligence, could have been talking about your wealth, could have said you're poor, could any number of things could have been delivered to you. Why would they deliver that to you? Consider this, that you were the threat. They perceived you to be the threat. Most of us think that, oh, they're the threat. Oh, they're the threat. I'm just little old me, and I have to be safe. But other people perceive us to be the threats, and then all of a sudden you go like, oh, Oh. It's interesting. I've had people say, gee, my mother-in-law is unkind to me. Really? Yeah. She's a threat to me. So, well, wait a minute. You recognize she's unkind to you. She's in fight, right? She perceives you to be the threat. You're taking her son or, it's like, or her daughter. Oh. Yeah, and she's trying to hold on to that. That's the fourth driving need that Christ talks about in Christ Returns, reveals startling truth. You know, hold on to our possessions, family, status, power, money, influence, property. It's like, oh, so you're the threat. Wow, I never considered myself the threat. And that light goes on for people, and then all of a sudden they see things differently. When you look at your family overall, your father, your mother, your grandparents, siblings, cousins, others, aunts and uncles maybe, how did you make them all about you? Oh, my cousin, he was, and then we make it about us because we compare ourselves to him. Oh, I'm superior to him. No, I'm inferior to him. But we make it about us. If you wrote this sentence out, it would be an interesting exercise for you. Three different blanks in this sentence. My blank is blank, and therefore I am blank. My blank is blank, and therefore I am blank. Fill in the blank. You already have. You've done that probably hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of times. We did that as children. We repeated that because we're trying to make sense of the world, trying to make sense of life. And those statements shapes our identity for better or for worse. Back to the fragments of ourselves. Our viewpoints tend to make the separation of the parts worse than it has to be. Oh, I don't like that part of me. Oh, I don't like that emotional part of me. Oh, I don't like that physical part of me. Oh, I don't like that smart alecky part of me. I don't like that fill in the blank. Sure. We're trying to protect ourselves by trying to avoid pain and pleasantness. That's it. That's why, oh, I got to keep that away. I don't want to look at that bad part of me, because maybe I'll be judged and then go to hell. Like, oh, I don't know, I gotta overlook looking at this. But as we change viewpoints and have compassion for ourselves, they're just energy exchange experiences. And our parts in these collisions get separated from us. But we can welcome them back. We can welcome them back. We don't have to avoid them. We don't have to reject them. We don't have to push them off. We can bond with them. We can bring them back, and we can become whole. Unlike some cards in which the aces are the highest and most powerful cards, you know, somebody plays an ace, it's like, oh, game over. They just won that trick or hand. In our case, we can convert our own aces, adverse childhood experiences, into compassion for ourselves and for other people. We can convert those aces into strengths because we've survived them. They made us stronger. And we can use them to create a renewed commitment to be creative, loving, intelligent, and powerful beings. We can do that. We can lighten up and play the aces. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.